You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 424 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Washington, home of the four-time U.S. Open Cup champion, Seattle Sounders.
Wow.
Okay.
Kind of confusing to be the home of the Seattle teams, now that I think about it with Renton, but for some reason it just rolls off the tongue with the Seahawks.
Oh, it really rolled off the tongue. Well, we are not coming to you from two different Washingtons today. We are together for the first time in a long time.
I don't know when the last time was, but it's been a minute. I have not seen you in a very long period of time except via Zoom.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
So long ago that maybe the Mariners weren't leading the AL West the last time that we podcasted in person.
Really?
I don't know if it's plausible.
No way. They've been leading the AL West for a long time.
I mean, I don't know. I can go review.
No,
the
you're
notes.
Wrong. I definitely did it. We were sitting here at the table when I was like AOS champion, AOS leader, okay. Seattle Mariners. I guarantee you that happened.
I mean, it's possible. The last time we recorded in person was May 28th ish. It was the final week of May. So I don't know when.
May 28th ish.
Well, the week before was May 21st. So usually it's about 1 week.
Well, speaking of the first place Seattle Mariners, for now, it is the Ken Griffey Jr. edition, of course, of the Pelton Cast.
It sure is.
And Desmond Mason?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Shouts to the famous cousin Katie. Big Desmond Mason fan. Sean Springs edition.
Okay. And of the Beast Mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a pretty good one, 24. That would be a good question. What's the best Seattle jersey number?
This has to be it. Right there, you just named like Randy Johnson and Ichiro are both 51. Is that right?
Yes, that's the best Mariners number. I mean, 10 is pretty.
I'm sorry, but Ken Griffey Jr.'s contributions were good enough to trump both Randy Johnson and Ichiro.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
He's maybe the most important baseball player of like the last 40 years.
I mean, we'll talk about a contribution that Ken Griffey Jr. made. Number 10 has Jim Zorn, Nate McMillan, Sue Bird, Kelsey Plum, and Jake Locker. That's a pretty deep
those
group.
Are all good, but there's not Sue Bird is like the only one who's like Mount Rushmore important.
I mean, Marshawn is probably better than the number two there. We've also got Donald Watts and Jerome Pathon
at 24.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah, those
I'm
are
like,
filling
these
out
are adding to your 10 contribution.
These
no offense to Donald Watts and Jerome Pathon, but
well, we missed this one, of course, Jewel Lloyd.
Oh, there you go.
So yeah, it is 24. It probably is 24.
Are there any other notable 20s?
Nobody that notable.
Or three. Who else do we have at three?
A-Rod, Brandon Roy.
Oh, that's
Jake Browning. There's some interesting threes
so
out there.
So Russ, you have probably the most important Seahawk player of all time.
Yeah.
Plus A-Rod.
I was having a conversation
the
today.
Baseball player to ever play in the city of Seattle.
I was having
pretty
a conversation today
right?
On the most the most popular Seattle athletes of all time because I was being asked where Sean Kemp ranked on that list, and you know I was going through it, and my explanation of Russ was like right now not so high, but in a couple of years,
give it a
when
second.
This all blows over, he'll be
the
way back up
most
there.
Most popular Seattle athletes of all time.
Well, just like this, you know, Seattle Mount Rushmore, more or less.
Who did you name?
Well, Sue Bird, Peyton, Griffey, Edgar, Russ. That's, I think, the combination.
You don't think Marshawn?
No, I don't think he's that high.
I don't even
think Marshawn. I love Marshawn. I don't know. Is he the number two Seahawk or is it Bobby Wagner?
I'm just being real with you. Who is this conversation with?
Someone who's not from here.
Like, how large of a scale of Seattle are we talking about? Because if we're being honest with ourselves, Sue Bird is not on the list.
I'm just being real. That's not true.
For the Pelton Cast listenership and for us, yes. But if we're talking about like the greater Seattle sports
I don't think
fans,
you understand how popular Sue Bird is.
I think you're in a little bit of a Sue Bird bubble.
I'm not saying I'm not in a Sue Bird bubble. I'm saying you're in a not understanding Sue Bird bubble. Like,
I don't really know how to respond to that. I'm just saying if you're talking
extremely
Seattle overall.
I mean, I agree that like if the we're Stormer, doing this like, on KJR, they're probably going to think of several Seahawks players before they think of Zubert. But if you poll the people of Seattle on popularity, the two single most popular athletes will be Zubert and Edgar.
I absolutely disagree with this. You think if you pulled every single person in Seattle and they were like...
Well, I mean, they've got to be a native Seattleite or at least have been here a long period of time.
Okay, now we have more rules.
I mean, they can't just...
or whatever.
They just can't have moved here to
we're
going to
need to see
Amazon.
Some birth certificates, obviously. But like... That's your stipulation.
They're going to name some Kraken player.
I like that you couldn't even come up with a single Kraken player's name.
I can't even
with
several Kraken players. I don't know who they would choose.
This hypothetical Seattleite that you're mad at?
I'm not mad at them. I'm just saying they're not a representative sample. We talked about not gatekeeping the bandwagon.
If you were...
back when there was a bandwagon.
So funny. Just me now. Now I'm being mocked for still paying attention to the Mariners. But if you pull people live in Seattle...
I think you're being mocked for your way of describing...
10-plus years, right? And if you went to every single person, you're like, who's the most popular athlete in Seattle history? I think GP is the first answer, personally.
GP doesn't live here. That's a big demerit in his case.
It's a Griffey GP.
Also doesn't live here.
It doesn't matter. Those athletes are popular still.
But there's some people that, I mean, Gary didn't request a trade. He just wanted an extension and got traded because of it.
How about this? If you were to go to a Mariners game and you were to like look at who the most common jerseys are in the stadium now, it is definitely more Griffey's than Edgar's. Julio is probably number one. Julio's almost certainly number one. Ichiro might even be number two over any active Mariner.
This is plausible. Ichiro is worth a conversation on this list.
It's some
as well.
Sort of combination of Ichiro, Felix, Griffey in there. But the fact that Griffey played, like, I mean, it wasn't that much earlier than it was like a decade before Ichiro or whatever. That Griffey has maintained that popularity. And overall, like, Griffey's, to me, is easily ahead of Edgar. I'm sorry. Like,
I mean, Griffey's a better player, but I think you're underestimating the effect of having played only for the Mariners.
I think you're overjudging the amount of belovedness among a smaller group and not the larger sample. And that's what I'm saying.
If you're talking about people that don't know anything.
That's what I'm saying about Zubert too. Like, oh, so now they have to know things?
If you're asking Jan about Mariners.
That's the people that I'm talking about. Literally, oh, now you're excluding Jan? Literally born and raised, has lived in Seattle for 70 years. And you're like, well, she doesn't fit within this group of people.
I mean, first off, Jan would say Zubert, for the record.
I absolutely. In fact, I'm like borderline like we should call Jan right now.
Oh, no.
As the sample size. Hold on. Let's see if she'll answer.
Oh, no. We do not have time for this.
Hold on.
We do not have time for
I'm
this.
I'm just
going to
see if she'll answer, and I'll see if it'll be recorded.
No, it's not going to come out as good quality audio. I mean, if anything, we'd have to call her via Skype. I'm sure I still have some Skype credits left from back when we
just
used to conduct
on,
interviews
hold on a
there.
Second. How many players? Two? What are we asking?
Four.
Four.
It's a Mount Rushmore. Who's on your Mount Rushmore of Seattle sports?
Hey, Jan. Nothing is wrong. We have a question for you. You're being
Did
recorded
you hear
right
about
now.
The Southern Heights fire, first
oh,
off.
Oh, yeah. Kevin wants to know if you heard that there was a fire at Southern Heights on the roof. Did you hear about that?
I saw it.
You okay. saw the fire?
Well, the fire was out when I went there, but they were like, I saw like, you know, 10 fire trucks surrounding.
Oh, my God.
Building.
This was in Boulevard Park, Washington.
Was the building damaged at all?
Well, it looked like they were all standing around looking at the roof. I mean, I've never seen that many fireworks in one place.
That's crazy. Fireworks are illegal in Boulevard Park, right? Do they have big signs up there being like, no fireworks on? Like,
fireworks are illegal every place.
Okay. It's King County overall, because it used to be legal.
How could it be fireworks? It's not the 4th of July. You think they were shooting off
fireworks? Oh, who would shoot off fireworks? Literally, I heard one earlier today.
I heard several last night, for the record. All right, but let's not get bogged down into the separate debate.
Okay, it's kind of late at night, but I remember that. I had to take my car up to get looked at this morning. I had to be there at 7:30. And as I drive up the hill, I see nothing but fireworks.
Huh.
So but the fire, there was no sign of a real actual fire. They already had put it out.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay.
It didn't even look black. It was just like they were just staring at the kind of the roof, and I don't know. It didn't look burnt, but something must have happened to have that many fire trucks there.
Okay. Fair enough. We have a question for you, though, Jan.
Was it on the news?
It was in the Seattle Times. That's where I learned of it.
Oh.
Anyway, we have a question for you, Jan.
Okay.
Who all-time Seattle athletes, who do you think are the four most popular athletes?
Who are the four on Mount Rushmore?
Mount Rushmore Seattle athletes, all-time, everybody, to you.
Probably Gary Payton. It would have used to have been Russell Wilson, but I don't think it will be anymore.
give it time.
Probably Griffey. Okay, so we're saying Griffey and Gary Payton. I'm not really sure about Sean Kemp anymore either, since these people, there's been such a problem. Maybe let me think. What's his name? You know, the guy on the Mariners. Martinez? What was his name?
Edgar Martinez?
Yeah, maybe Edgar Martinez. Okay, so but Edgar Martinez, Griffey, Gary Payton.
And one more?
And this is Seattle all time?
All time.
God. I mean, back in the day, that guy that became a senator, he was pretty popular.
Steve Largent?
Yes. I think I put him.
Okay.
What, was this some kind of poll?
No, Kevin had a perspective about this that I had to debunk, and I think you ended up agreeing with me, so.
About the part about certain people have gotten too much trouble and they're not favorites anymore.
No, not
that, just who people would name. Because I said that Griffey is like, he thought Edgar Martinez would be ahead of Griffey, which I do not.
No, I said he would be more popular. Griffey was on my Mount Rushmore, to be clear. I think Edgar is just more universally popular.
Mm-hmm.
But Mom surely forgot about the fourth person I had on there, which is Sue Bird.
Even thought about Super.
Hmm.
That's really bad, isn't it? That's really bad. Super would be on my all-time great list. I totally forgot. I was thinking, I was really trying, but it is kind of late at night, and I'm watching Beverly Hills Cop, the new one.
All right, well, we'll let you get back to that. Thank you for right. chatting with us.
Bye.
I'm at
house. Okay. All right.
We're recording a podcast right now.
House. We're currently recording a podcast.
Am I live on it?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that it's not live.
Yeah, but I know. Okay, it's recorded though.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I will take back Super.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'm sorry. Take back Steve
Larkin.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the old time was throwing her a little bit. She was going too far back in the annals because she didn't name any current athletes. Not that Sue is current at the moment, but close enough.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Jan.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night.
That was just amazing content, if we're being honest.
Should we bring in the famous cousin Katie this way? Like, it's logistically hard to record via Zoom when we're in person.
So to just, answer? You're saying I should call Katie right now?
No, I don't know. No, we've already got too far in this particular episode. But I'm just saying in the future, that's a way to bring in the famous cousin Katie.
I would like to note Jan did not think of Sue Bird. Literally, she did not even mention the name.
But as soon as Sue Bird was mentioned to her, she agreed.
I'm just saying that my point is being made based upon Jan's answer.
I think both
answer.
Of our points are being made.
We all take credit.
All right, it's an Oops All Toast podcast, so let's get into it. Starting with...
Toast to Jan.
I mean, yes. toast to A New Talking Taco Time, which is out if you have not listened to it already. A news update. It had been over 5 months since we recorded, so there was a lot to discuss, including your questions. I discovered this after the fact. I was searching further on Reddit for Talking Taco Time discussion.
Yes.
And they were wondering about the hot sauce. So we answered their question without knowing it was their question.
I was a little shocked that Chris wasn't more negative on the hot sauce.
It was a bit of a surprise to me too, honestly.
He was like pretty positive overall on this podcast.
There are a lot of takes out there, I would say, on the hot sauce. So we will continue to monitor that situation, obviously. In an amazing coincidence, mere hours after Talking Taco Time came out, the Seattle Times had a story about the Wallingford location closing with an update that... Did you see? Don't look at the notes.
I saw it in the notes.
Okay, what this will become in the march of progress. The iconic glass Taco Time in Wallingford, which apparently did not open, is a Taco Time. When it was first built in 1990, it was not. That I also learned from the article. It became a Taco Time in 1994.
Wow.
It will now become a Chipotle.
Okay, 1994, because I was going to say, 1990 U-District. A lot of music was happening in the U-District. Can we surmise that Eddie Vedder ate at that Taco Time? Once you get to 94, though, all of a sudden, he's pretty famous. So
I don't think that's stopping Eddie Vedder necessarily from going through the drive-thru.
I'm just saying, if it would have been 1990,
although Randy wouldn't record that as an official visit. So would Eddie Vedder record?
So did Eddie Vedder even go there?
Eddie Vedder.
In this hypothetical scenario.
Come on the pod.
To talk Taco Time.
Oh my God. Can you imagine if we had any better on Talking Taco Time?
I'm just going to throw this out there. Transplants. Eddie Vedder, famously a transplant to Seattle, has lived here for a long while now.
So you're saying he might not be a Taco Time guy?
If he'd been born and raised in Seattle, I think, I'm not sure about Kurt Cobain in Aberdeen. There's no Taco Times in Aberdeen, are there?
Aberdeen itself? I don't think so. I'd have to look up. I mean,
Kelso Longview would probably be the closest.
Go to the Olympia.
Olympia, okay.
Chris Novoselic, you think he's a Taco Time guy?
Absolutely, I do.
I think he's got to be. I've seen Chris
That's
Novoselic.
Who we can universally agree is a Taco Time guy is Chris Novoselic. But it is an interesting thought to imagine 90s grunge artists cruise into the Wallingford Taco Time.
It is a great thought to think about, yes.
And now, I look, grunge is dead. So is Taco Time, and now it's a Chipotle.
You go play a gig at Key Arena and go down to the Inner Bay Taco Time location.
It's like a little bit too on the nose that it's becoming a Chipotle.
It's so on the nose. Way too on
I
the nose.
I bet it's going to be an extraordinarily successful Chipotle also.
Oh, dear. We did also learn from that article, in case you were worried about the employees at that Taco Time location, they will have the option to transfer to other Taco Times in All the right. area. So... next up, the Olympics are coming. Congrats to the Storms, Ezzie Megbegor and Sammy Whitcomb, as well as Storm legend Lauren Jackson for the fifth time at age 43.
Wow.
All named to the Australian Opals Olympic team.
We have got to love this. We're cheering for Australia in this one, right?
I mean, they have three Storm players, essentially. The USA only has one in Jewel Lloyd. You have Brianna Stewart as well, but I think the numbers speak for themselves there.
Is Lauren Jackson, the Australian Opals, is she like old Patrick Ewing, like Sonic's Patrick Ewing on that team? Like after every game, are there just massive ice packs on her knees?
I have to imagine, so I haven't seen that specifically.
Okay. I want to see a photo of her just looking kind of exhausted.
But who would have imagined that Lauren Jackson, who also played in the 2000 Olympics, so she played in the Olympics before Subert did.
Wow.
And after. Subert played in 5 Olympics, and Lauren Jackson has managed to play in Olympics before and after.
This is an incredible career. Wait, who's the person all time who's played...
in the most basketball Olympics?
Yeah.
I have to assume it's Oscar Schmidt, but I'd have to look it up.
From?
Brazil.
Brazil, okay. And just, like, kept grinding.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were throwing him off the Brazilian national team.
Well, it's funny, like LeBron famously has had a very long career, right?
Yeah.
But she was playing in the Olympics when LeBron was like a sophomore in high school.
That is correct.
And now she's still, LeBron is not, is he on the current U.S. team?
He is.
Okay.
I told you this early information literally minutes ago.
I mean, that's an impressive feat as is. Basically, the entire NBA has turned over aside from him and Chris Paul, right?
Over the course of Lauren Jackson's...
LeBron's career.
Over LeBron's career, Chris Paul came in after him.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, he was 04?
No, he was 05.
Oh, wow. Okay. So LeBron is the old, like, the longest tenured player in the NBA.
Correct.
And Lauren Jackson was playing in an Olympics when he was in high school. It's an incredible feat.
It's pretty wild.
If we're being honest with ourselves, if there's one team that needs a little jolt, right? A shot of energy, an injection, you're Seattle Storm.
I don't know that they are necessarily.
Now, is that, look, they've lost two out of the last three. You know, it's a tough loss.
They do now have the 7-day. Okay, so several. No one has ever played in more than five Olympics. LJ will tie the record. Tarasi will set the record because she's playing in her sixth Olympics.
What year did Diana Taurasi play in the Olympics for the first time?
2004, same as Sue.
How is that her sixth then? Oh, because Lauren Jackson missed some.
Lauren Jackson missed two.
Oh, so if she would have played three, in every
she might have played
one.
In. She might have missed three because she wouldn't have in 2016, 2020.
Because she was retired.
Yes.
And then came back.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's more impressive. I agree. If she had played in every single one, she would be the longest tenured Olympian basketball player.
Yes. Oscar Schmidt is among the many who have played in five in the men's side.
In five. But so if Lauren Jackson had played in 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020, and 2024, that would be seven.
Is Rudy Fernandez going for six this year? Is he on the roster?
Oh, that's
still?
Blazers legend Rudy Fernandez.
That is
you.
Blazers legend Rudy Fernandez. We remember fondly his 2008 Olympics right before his rookie season.
I actually never have paid attention to the Olympic basketball.
Okay.
I'm mostly interested in the fact that Lauren Jackson's playing in this.
Yeah.
Less interested in Olympic basketball.
Also members of the Australian Olympic team, former Storm players Jade Melbourne.
There we go.
And Stephanie Talbot. Meanwhile, Gabby Williams was named to the French national team. Obviously, no surprise there.
It's a surprise to me because I didn't know she was French.
yes, she is. I don't know if she's technically, I don't think she counts as their naturalized. I'm not sure on that one, but because she has some French heritage. All right, congrats next up to Logan Gilbert on being selected for his first MLB All-Star game as the Mariners' lone representative.
All of the Mariners' All-Star.
Lo, their mini All-Star.
Logan Gilbert's having a great season, though.
He is, and a great outing on Tuesday night. There's a reason I mentioned home of the four-time U.S. Open Cup champions at the beginning here, because we have a congrats to the Sounders on reaching the semifinals of the U.S. Open Cup for the first time since 2014, which I believe was their last of their four championships during their first 6 years in MLS. They will host LAFC in the semifinals, showdown, a rematch. Was that a playoffs matchup last year?
You probably should ask me that.
Yeah, it definitely would be the one to know. notably, the conference final back in 2019 before they won their last MLS Cup, so that same stage. That time LAFC hosted. Sounders jumped out to an early 2-0 lead over the Sacramento, but pleading something close to a first-choice lineup in front of Andrew Thomas in goal. They did allow a goal just after halftime, but then held Sacramento to see out the victory. So exciting. The Sounders now two wins away from potentially adding another trophy to their crowded case. All right, we talked last week about the departure of UW baseball coach Jason Kelly. We now welcome new UW baseball head coach Eddie Smith. The Olympia native played at Lacey High School and Centralia Community College before finishing his career at Notre Dame. His first head coaching experience came at Lower Columbia College in Longview.
So
this man has been all over. He knows a lot of taco times, this man. Later hitting coach at LSU in Tulane, where he also served as recruiting coordinator before becoming the head coach at Utah Valley and improving the record by 9 wins in 2022, 15 in 2023. Last season's 18 WAC wins tied a school record. So
fair enough.
Very excited to have Eddie Smith.
My favorite part about this, about the Eddies, like, right, you have like Jed Fish coming in and there's all these hype videos, like Twitter, everything about it. Eddie Smith was just like announced on Twitter and he just posts, "Go Dogs." And I'm like, hell yeah, Eddie Smith, go Dogs. That's it. Period. We are moving on to baseball. the whole thing between baseball and basketball, just how drastically different it is for the coaches and how much internet hype they have to do.
Very different.
I was like, all right, go Dogs. Well, Eddie Smith's the coach now. I feel like with this hire, they went just like not too flashy. This was one where it was like, you know what? Let's just find a guy who's been around Seattle.
Local ties.
Yeah. It's a little different than, say, like, a football coach or a basketball coach. Obviously, a basketball coach has UW ties. But where you want to make a bigger splash, you're like, where you exist on the national stage. This was like, if things go well, I hope that they don't leave to be a pitching coach in the SEC. Or even if things go badly. Overall, I know that there are some ties to Louisiana, but like,
I mean, he was previously the hitting coach at LSU and exactly. Chose to leave that to go to Utah Valley.
Yeah.
So you would think UW is still there. Yeah. Utah Valley in the pecking order. I don't know.
It also makes you think that maybe UW's former coach might have seen some writing on the wall with regards to the program.
I don't know if it's writing on the wall as much as, like I mentioned last week, the fact that Pat Chun didn't hire him.
Yes.
It throws things off.
It changes the equilibrium. Writing on the wall. I wouldn't say writing on the wall. I'm just talking about...
Well, I don't think he was in danger of getting fired immediately. It's just you don't have the same support
There's a direction that the program was heading, and for Eddie Smith just being like... The program, they needed a little bit of a restart after that.
I don't know if I'd say that.
You wouldn't say that? It was a horrendous season.
It was a down season, but, I mean, you ran the school for 2 years, and the first one was extraordinarily good.
The second one was bad, and there was a new AD, and he left to be, again, the same level of coach that Eddie Smith left to go be the coach at Utah Valley.
We know Texas A&M has more revenue than LSU. I guess maybe they're paying that much more.
I mean, I would assume that they probably are, but yes.
I don't know if they are. I mean, baseball's really big at LSU. Shouts to Warren Morris.
Wait, so was he the pitching coach? You said he was the pitching coach at LSU?
No, he was the hitting coach.
Oh, the hitting coach.
He's an offensive background.
Okay, this is
so totally different.
Okay. Radically different.
Because hitting is fun.
I mean, we well documented. We fought a lot about this last week. Hitting, more important than pitching.
I mean, yes. I'm just saying. It's not like the Mariners are like, well, I guess we shouldn't bother developing any hitters. Let's just develop pitchers.
We can fight about that later.
All right, a toast to Ballard FC, which announced plans to add a USLW team in 2025 to play at Interbay Stadium, added 25 female investors to its ownership group, including several Reign players and Storm co-owner Ginny Gilder.
Okay.
I don't know if you knew this. Ballard FC is now playing their men's games at Memorial Stadium. I discovered that when I was at Seattle Center
and you looked over
and heard the game going on. It was like, huh, there sure are a lot of people here wearing Ballard FC merchandise.
I love when news is discovered just by being around.
Yeah.
Just like Jan in the fire.
All right. Missed this one a little bit ago, but the Seattle Times did out of a story on it this week. The Jefferson Park Golf Course has been renamed the Bill Wright Golf Complex in honor of the late Seattle native and Franklin High grad who learned to play at Jefferson before becoming the first black winner of a USGA championship by winning the U.S. Public Links title in 1959.
Okay.
So a well-deserved honor, overdue. I mentioned this earlier. Happy 25th birthday to T-Mobile Park.
You mentioned this earlier?
Which opened because I mentioned there was something coming on Griffey.
Oh.
It's the house that Griffey built, which opened July 15th, 1999.
And ended up being able to play there. to me, it's always Safeco Field. Forever, if we're talking about corporate brands. But it was an investment that the city made that probably led dominoes to the Sonics moving, and that's great.
I mean, I'm not going to be upset about T-Mobile Park because of that, necessarily. I don't think we should have in 1995 been like, vote no, just in case the Sonics decide to move, because the arena that we literally are rebuilding right now is outdated.
If we would have had some foresight, we probably should have voted no, because arenas should be paid for by the wealthy people who own them.
I mean, yes, but we weren't quite at that point either. Lastly, this week, a farewell to Mariners president of business operations, Katie Griggs, who resigned in order to take the same job with the Baltimore Orioles back on her native East Coast. At least she didn't resign to take a pitching coach job in Texas A&M.
All right, fair enough. It was all because the Mariners drafted George Kirby instead of Gunnar Henderson. Had they drafted Gunnar Henderson with that pick, maybe she'd still be here.
Gunnar Henderson's really good at baseball, it turns out. George Kirby's quite good. Gunnar Henderson's really incredible. Well, it's time this week for the return of our search for Seattle's best cookie. I have finally been able to get you a chocolate chip cookie from De Laurenti. specialty market, which, a little background from their website, a store born out of a market marriage between Pete De Laurenti, who delivered bread at the market, and Mamie Marie Mistello, whose mother owned a grocery there. The couple bought the grocery from her mother in 1946, renaming it Pete's Italian Grocery at the time and offering specialty food. Their son, Louis, moved it to the current location in the market right at the entrance on First Avenue. Impossible to miss. Louis then sold the store in 2001 to a group of regulars, including Quinn Snyder's brother, Matt Snyder.
Wow. Okay.
I've told you this information has come up on the podcast before. I'm quite certain every time it's new to you. And their website also has this to say about their signature chocolate chip cookie. A lot has been said about this cookie. We think it's the best around. It's won awards and been enjoyed by thousands of our important customers. Buy one. You won't be disappointed. Oh, no. Oh, no. You didn't buy one.
Yeah. Maybe you should start first then.
I think the chocolate chips on this really stood out. They were quite melty and delicious. It's a little crispier, I think, than I would prefer this kind of. And it's a relatively flat cookie. I think I want a little more depth to my cookie, ideally. I would say it's in the one-star range for me.
It's the crunch is too much. It's a little too cooked. And
I mean, it's not like overcooked because you were still able to break it in half quite easily and have it be
it's some, close. It is gooey. Close, though. It's I mean, getting, it's getting had, into the red zone.
You also had this several hours after.
But that doesn't make a cookie crunchier.
Having it doesn't make it crunchier. I agree with that.
And I will say that the thing that is impressive about it is, I don't know if this is the temperature today or what, but like the chocolate chips were still very gooey despite having it hours later.
Yeah,
I think it was residing
in my car all day, so it wasn't a warm environment in my glove box.
But it got a little bit too far past. If it would have been just a hair softer, like a little bit of crunch, but the crunch was like, if you want your crunch to be like a 5, this was like an 8 of crunch. And that to me is like, we're being honest with ourselves. This is not Seattle's best cookie.
I mean, I think it goes back to something we've talked about a lot in this process. It's very challenging for places that are not cookie forward to have Seattle's best cookies, like realistically.
Yeah.
So they do offer multiple cookies. I tried the hazelnut chocolate chip the other time. I thought the chocolate chip was better. They also have a peanut butter option, which I have not yet tried.
I liked eating it, but it wasn't, considering some of the contenders that we have out there, I was just like, this is a good cookie. I don't mind it being flat necessarily, but it was just the crunchiness was the main thing. It felt to me like it wasn't like, oh, it was just one batch that was crunchy. This is how the cookie's made.
I agree.
And
some people want that. I mean, look, everyone's cookie preferences are different.
I agree, be inclusive but I of do this. Think, like, how long have they been making these cookies?
Unclear exactly how long.
I think there's a trend that newer cookies are softer.
Well, I agree with that. Although the Met Market, the cookie is the exception there.
But it's fat enough. If you're going to be crunchier, you have to be fatter so that you have more width to be soft. Because if it's a thin cookie and it's crunchy, then all of a sudden you have like literally just inches wise, like a tiny amount to be soft. And so if you're going to be a crunchier cookie, you have to be a much thicker cookie, if that makes sense, on the scale, but a thinner cookie. And I do think March of Progress.
Do I have to put the March of Progress on the glossary?
It's been two episodes. But like, the marketplace is telling people what they want from cookies. And the thing that they want from cookies, and that's why
cookies from the state of Utah.
I mean, maybe. I don't know if people want those. Like, we might have a story in like 6 months. Again, Rip to Mod Pizza. I don't know if we talked about that.
It's not,
obviously not going away, but like,
yes.
Rip to Mod Pizza for filing for bankruptcy.
They have not yet filed for bankruptcy. The Seattle Times reported today that they are seeking to avoid filing for bankruptcy.
Me too.
some of us more actively than others.
Then again, aren't we all? But I wouldn't be shocked if, like, in 2 years it was like Crumble Cookies files for bankruptcy. You know what I mean? It's not like
I mean, sure, but that's because they like Mod overexpanded.
Exactly.
Not because people don't want their cookies.
But no, what I'm saying is
not because people don't want cookies of that style.
Yeah, I agree with that. But sometimes I feel like if there's a number one takeaway from any of my perspectives about the Pelton cast in general is that sometimes things can remain small and we can be okay with that. And it is the hardest thing for people.
Stop telling Flower Box to go faster. Just let them cook, literally.
But you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I do, it
is a beautiful thing to have somebody who is at their perfect capacity, or is maybe even under their perfect capacity, or whatever. Like, let's let beautiful things exist without overextending ourselves. And places like Crave, places like Crumble, places like Mod Pizza are pure capitalism.
Not really sure how this is relevant to the Di Loretti cookie.
But anyway, I'm just saying, the marketplace is telling us what it wants from cookies in a good way in this situation. And that is a softer cookie. And that's why the newer cookies are softer. And that's why I think, realistically speaking, De Laurentiis probably is not Seattle's best cookie.
All right. I wanted to shout out a place that I don't think is a contender for Seattle's best cookie necessarily. But I had a delicious cookie there the other week because I'm not intending to get a cookie. So Ensenada Cafe in Everett, very far north for the Pelton cast, but somehow it's become a 4th of July tradition.
I've never heard of it. Everett.
Yes. It's a Filipino place. I think I may have mentioned it when I was talking about Shea Boggs on Beacon Hill, which offers some similar stuff. But like the Tres Leches cake, Ube Tres Leches cake, and their chicken adobo that is like fall off the bone are the reasons I go there. But this time they had an ube cookie, and I was like, I can't not get the ube cookie. What 100%. Am I not competing?
Yes.
And I would say another place that we're not going to talk about, I think, in our search for Seattle's best cookie, unfortunately, that we talked about a lot the first time, was Hood Famous. And
why are we not going to talk? Because they don't have cookies, or?
I love their ube cheesecake.
Uh-huh.
Is me in there for Seattle's best dessert?
I would like to. I haven't been to Hood Famous in forever.
The cookie is just is not as good as the ube cheesecake, in my opinion.
Okay, well, I still want to go there.
Okay, you can do that. But this
I can have extracurricular cookies.
This is exactly what I wanted in ube cookie. It was light and delicious, and they have like white chocolate chips in there. So if you're in the Everett area, again, cannot recommend Ensenada Cafe any more strongly for a variety of items, including the ube cookie. So there you go. What?
Before we get into our next topic, NBA publicly announced their new TV deal today, correct?
Did not do that.
Oh, they didn't?
The Athletic reported that the TV deals, the ink has finally dried on them.
Okay.
The legalese has finished.
So are we able to talk about this now, or does this change anything at all? Does this add anything further to the conversation, or is it literally just a milestone that was going to happen either way, but everything else remains mostly unchanged?
It's a milestone that was going to happen either way. I would say from a timing perspective, one of the things that was reported by The Athletic, I think this was Andrew Marchand who had this story, that the Board of Governors will be taking up these contracts at their meeting in Las Vegas next week, which they're probably not going to both do that and convene an expansion committee. So I don't think we will see an expansion committee imminently.
And when is the next time? It's like right around the beginning of the season.
October is typically the next Board of Governors meeting.
Okay. So that is likely to be, will it be public knowledge when there is an expansion committee?
I think that Adam Silver would probably address that in his remarks to the media after these Board of Governors meetings.
Okay, so one milestone is more or less down. The next milestone is coming in October for expansion.
I mean, I'm not going to say that it's specifically
the next milestone
in October.
May be
I'm just saying
in October. How about that?
Realistically, that's what seems realistic to me.
Okay.
All right, no takes this week?
It really feels like a no takes week.
Oh,
we'll have the mid-season takes next week.
The take is no takes.
The take. I mean, it's like.
You didn't want to get the Mariners are back just because they took the first two games of the
honestly,
better cup?
I care too much about the Mariners to do takes this week. I told you, I hate everything about this team. I'm going to watch every single inning. Like, I'm being cautious right now. I'm being careful. They've won two games in a row.
People are so ready to declare the Mariners back, myself included.
I've declared the Mariners back, but not. I can't just do it in take form.
Just Friday night when they beat the Blue Jays, when all those sad Canadians were at T-Mobile Park, I was ready. I was ready to go, especially after Julio had homered on the 4th of July. Like, it was an exciting time. And then they lost the last two games against the Blue Jays, the Sunday one in extremely frustrating fashion. They had they have the bases loaded in the 8th with one out and couldn't get a run home in a tie game, and then lost in the 10th.
I didn't see any of it.
They at least had runners second and third with one out in the 8th inning and could not score. But Tuesday in San Diego, Julio Rodriguez's first four-hit game since April 20th. Saw him, I think pretty much all of those resulted in either a run or an RBI.
Was it a three-hit game?
No.
It's four hits?
Yeah.
Four hits? All right.
Not one, not two, not three, but four hits. Again, I looked up when the last time was to double-check this, and that was definitely on the list. Our guy Dom Canzone was placed on the injured list with an adductor strain on Wednesday. Jonathan Clase back up. Canzone suffered that injury, making a diving catch on Sunday. So hopefully it won't be too long after the All-Star break for him. In happier injury news, Gregory Santos back in the bullpen. Exciting to see it. I guess not back in the bullpen. He's just in the bullpen.
In the bullpen. It was exciting to see it. Sparks flying in his first batter that he faced, Jerks and Profar.
Brian Wu is set to start this weekend against the Angels, most likely on Saturday. And Gabe Spire getting set for a rehab stint with AAA Tacoma over the weekend at New Mexico. So Mariners pitching staff, knock on wood, getting healthy.
Yeah, I mean, this series win, it was their first series win in, I believe, the last six series?
They had lost six in series in a row prior to this, yes.
Kind of an incredible number. I mean, considering that the Mariners' record is 50-43, like, again, one of those things, if you could hear it in a vacuum and be like, the Mariners lost six series in a row, but they're still, well, I guess they were five games over 500 before this.
But still in first place.
But still in first place, having lost six series in a row, you'd be like, all right, I will take that. And realistically speaking at this point, 50-43, I'll probably take it right now.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, again, we'll have a mid-season perspective after this weekend, but I think it's fine. I think the other piece is that it does seem pretty evident, whether you trust any reporting or not, that the Mariners, at the very least, mildly see themselves as buyers heading into the trade deadline.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not questioning the reporting because I think the Mariners have, as I said on Discord, I think the Mariners have had conversations about all these star hitters that might be available. I think that every team has conversations about pretty much everyone. Having a conversation is a really low bar to clear.
Yes. Calling and making a phone call and being like, what is the price tag for somebody like Luis Robert, for somebody like Vlad Guerrero, like,
because you never know when they might say yes.
Having those conversations, but it's more of, you start those conversations now to get serious about the conversations 3 weeks from now.
Of course.
And I think the series, I mean, this is not like even a take, really. This four game set with Anaheim is important, as you call them.
I said that on air, I merely said that Brian Wu was set to start in Anaheim.
The most important series when viewing whether the Mariners are going to be buyers or sellers at the deadline, they're probably not going to be sellers, realistically speaking, but how aggressive they're going to be about buying comes right after the trade deadline at home against the Houston Astros.
Oh, I didn't realize they play. They're right after the trade deadline they play?
No, not after right after the All-Star break.
Okay.
Right after the All-Star break, three games set with the Astros, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Seattle. And if the Mariners can sweep or win two out of three in that series, and have a 4-5 game lead at that point. You know, there's still more baseball to be played after that, but like that is
there's still a lot of baseball. Because let's be clear that the first time we got excited about the Mariners' playoff chances was after they did sweep the Astros, right?
Yes. But this is what is going to dictate, I think, for them, exactly how aggressive they are.
Oh, no, they swept the Rangers. I'm sorry.
In these conversations.
That's what I'm thinking of. They took 3 out of 4 from Houston, but that was much earlier. So they are right now 5-2 in the season series against the Astros. How many games do they have remaining against Houston?
Just 6 more.
So if there's a total of 13 games and they've won 5, they need 2 wins. Taking 2 out of 3 against Houston would clinch the tiebreaker in addition to increasing their lead in the AL West.
That's a good point right now. I mean, and that matters also in a division that there's a 2-game lead in. So that's going to be the most deciding factor. Obviously, I'd be very excited about if they did go out and make a play for one of these players. And I still think, like, my perspective hasn't changed on what they should do at the deadline unless something crazy happens between now and then. And especially, like, that's... We should obviously want Julio to be playing well, but, like, the better that all the hitters do now is not a reason to not be buyers. It's the reason to be more aggressive as buyers, because if you have Julio, if you were to believe the logic that the Mariners will tell you, which is that Julio is a second-half hitter or whatever, he's going to turn it on, he has turned it on, that's all the more reason to go out and get another bat and really make a play here to get the second seed in the playoffs and be there in the playoffs, win the division, be there in the second seed and beyond.
Do they have a realistic chance at the second seed?
I mean, they have a realistic chance of everything. There's a million games. All of these teams, like if you looked at it 2 weeks ago, you would really know what, you would feel like you knew what was evident about baseball. And then everything changes in like a two-week period.
I don't know. There's 7.5 games back of the Guardians right now and have already lost. That's tiebreaker. So,
I mean, the Guardians and the Orioles
could be the number one seed, yes. Yeah. Well, I've got some bad news for you about the tiebreaker with the Baltimore Orioles. Got some bad news. They still got a chance against the Yankees. So, you're telling me there's a chance.
You understand what I'm saying? Like, the Yankees are 3-7 in their last 10.
Yes, life comes at you fast.
Shit changes very quickly in baseball. It doesn't feel like it's going to in the moment. In the moment, you feel like everything is evident, but it is a very long season. Again, the Mariners had a 10-game lead not that long ago and then lost 6 straight series.
That actually was the point I didn't make on last week's pod that I hoped to, because I got bogged down for some reason in argument with you.
Your entire argument was that curses are real.
It wasn't my entire argument. I was just acknowledging the possibility that curses may be affecting the Mariners hitters. Zach Jabal raised some good points on the Discord about how, although the then Safeco Field played really well for average back in the early 2000s, bringing the fences in to make it more favorable for hitters, power hitting for right-handed batters in particular, has also had the effect of depressing batting averages, and that the mystery is why strikeouts seem to be so high at T-Mobile Park, because that's obviously not a, you know, dimensions issue per se. So more investigation needed on that one, I would say. what I was going to say is I had a friend who was on the Sonics Central message boards back in the day talking about the Sonics, Nick S., who his signature, when you had those sorts of things, way long before the Discord and Slack era, was nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems. And I think that is like a sports philosophy I take. That is a life philosophy I take. And the Mariners weren't as good as it seemed when they were 10 games up in the AL West. Things are not as bad for the Mariners as they seemed a week ago when they had lost, or when they had lost 6 consecutive series. Things are going to even out. So that's my perspective.
How bad would it seem if the team missed the playoffs for 20 straight years, Nick S.? Were things not as bad as they seemed, Nick?
I mean, look, it created some amazing content from John Boyce.
There you go. I'm just saying there might have been like just a short 2 decades where things were as bad as they seemed. But he's also on the Sonic Central message board. So let's just take a second to think about things are as good or as bad as they seem. It's like the NBA wouldn't move a team from Seattle, Washington that had won a championship to Oklahoma. So And I guess maybe things are as bad as they seem.
All right. The Kraken already finished their offseason, so the only news this past week is that Derek Laxdal has been named Dan Bylsma's replacement as head coach of the Coachella Valley Firebirds. Laxdal spent 5+ seasons as a head coach in the AHL previously for the Texas Stars before joining the big club as an assistant coach for 2+ seasons. Laxdal was most recently OHL Coach of the Year with the Ottawa Generals.
Derek Laxdal and Dave Haxdal.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Seattle Sounders, besides the Open Cup win Tuesday, a 2-0 win at home Saturday against New England Revolution to cap their 3-game MLS homestand, finally made it easy, getting an early goal from Jordan Morris in the 15th minute, doubling their lead through Albert Rushnak, the red-hot Albert Rushnak in the 81st minute, 3 goals in the last 2 weeks. Nuhu started, went the full 90, while Raul Ruidíaz played off the bench after their 1 week absence. Only a slight XG advantage for the Sounders, but they had 7 shots on target among their 15 total. That win moved the Sounders into 7th in the West with 31 points, clear of the play-in for 8th and 9th. Houston still has a match in hand and sits just 1 point back, so they're ahead on points per match. But the Sounders plus 5 goal differential now tied for 6th in the West as they continue to make up ground. Key matchup coming Saturday in Austin. Los Verdes are also 1 point back of the Sounders, would move ahead of them with a win. So big for the Sounders to get at least a point on the road in that one. Seattle Reign FC off this week as players prepare for the Olympics. But the WNBA still going strong. Storm now 5-2 on their record 9-game homestand. They had an 8-game home winning streak snapped by Chicago on Friday night as part of a home and home against the Sky. Angel Reese saying, I don't know if she can really say, oh, you picked Neka Ogumeke over me. Exactly. But showing the Storm what could have been had they not traded that number 4 pick, had double doubles in both of those games. Now the longest double double streak in WNBA history. Is a rookie at 13 games and counting, and was a bigger scoring presence against the Storm than she usually is. So the Storm did beat the Sky despite that on Sunday before losing Wednesday on Kids Day to the Las Vegas Aces. A back and forth game to a degree. Storm controlled most of the first half. Then Las Vegas, a huge third quarter, 12-0 run to take the lead in this one for good. Storm, even though they were down 9 with a couple minutes left, did manage to get a three-point opportunity to a pair of threes that would have tied the game late. But Neko Gumake missed the first of those from the corner, and then Jewel Lloyd sort of forced an attempt from the top of the key that was off balance and missed.
Seeing them play against Vegas, obviously Vegas has been playing better, but like, did it feel like these teams, I didn't see any of this one, I'm not a kid, but like, did it feel like they were more evenly matched in this game? Like, if this were a playoff series, let's say it was a 5-game playoff series, what would be the outcome based upon your experience in this game?
Oh, I think the Aces would win, but I don't think that it would be a sweep. I think the Storm, you know, have shown that they can be competitive. Las Vegas has now, they did have their winning streak slap, but they're 8-2 in their last 10. I think that's like 8 of their last 9, in fact, in that span. They have now caught and passed the Storm in the standings. Also,
Vegas is like the Astros. We're just like, we know what's coming.
No, Vegas is even better than the Astros. The Astros were not arguably the best team in baseball history last year. But yes, we knew that they were coming. I think the Storm, if they're going to stay in that, get back into that top four, which they're now out of in the WNBA standings, they have a better chance of catching Minnesota or Connecticut than they do of catching Las Vegas, even though they're only a half game back. So that's really going to be the thing to watch. Mike Vorwell wrote about this in the Seattle Times after the game. The Storm has beaten Connecticut at home, and they have the one win in the first matchup with Las Vegas out of their games against the teams ahead of them. They are, let's see, they've lost 4-6. They're 2-6 against that group, and then 12-2 against the rest of the WNBA. So this is a clear split where it does seem like those top four have been ahead of the Storm, even though they're not necessarily that much ahead in the standings. And then the bottom group, even though Phoenix is only 2 games back, has been substantially worse than the Storm.
They're just the worst of the good teams.
Yes.
That's exactly what we basically thought they would be, and that's what they are.
We thought that they might be a little better than that. I mean, nobody expected that Minnesota and Connecticut were going to be right there at the top of the league.
Okay. We thought they would be in that range, though. We knew that they'd be behind a couple of teams. Let me ask you a question.
Minnesota has also won a couple in a row, even though they faced a serious injury with Nafisa Collier, their MVP candidate, out of the lineup lately. So that's been impressive.
Neko Gwumike, Skylar Diggins-Smith, obviously signing with the Storm this offseason. If you could run it back and you could just have Angel Reese but have another down year for the Storm, is that something that you would take? Obviously, long term, probably. But because I just look at this and I'm like, what are we doing here? Right?
But the question isn't whether we would take it. The question is whether Jewel Lloyd would take it. So I think
Is Jewel Lloyd good enough for that question to matter? You say with the Mariners, you're like, Julio's the timeline. That's it, right? Is Jewel Lloyd the timeline for the Storm? Not implying that Julio's good enough.
I mean, it's like right on the borderline. Because like having a good season, like winning basically two-thirds of your games, you know, being 9-3 at home, like all those things are good and important. And I do think there is still an element. We're moving away from this in the WNBA, but there is still an element where you can't plan too far in the future because in a league where teams move as frequently as they do, and it's been a while, but you know, occasionally fold, like it's harder to wait for, you know, this 4-year plan to
You can't have the process in the WNBA.
Exactly.
I see what you're saying. And I do think the thing that draws, like, free agents are drawn to playing with good players.
Yeah, and we're not talking about, again, this is not like the Chicago Bulls, like, going all in so that they can finish in the play-in.
Yeah.
Like, they are a good team. It is still plausible for them to finish in the top four, and then you would be favored to win a playoff series.
Okay.
But
fair enough.
Angel Reese has been so good that the answer, like, before the season, we talked about this, and my answer was unequivocally no, because I thought that there were the three top prospects with Camila Cardoso. And
how have the other three prospects been? Like, if there was a redraft, where does Angel Reese go?
I mean, Brink played pretty well before she suffered an ACL.
I guess you have to factor out the injury.
Yeah, I mean, not knowing that, I don't think that Reese has necessarily played well enough that I would take her over Brink at this point in a redraft. Because I do think at some point, like when you get high enough level outcomes, her lack of shooting range will be an issue. But she certainly would go lower than third.
And it was Camila Cardoso who was the third pick?
Yeah, also on Chicago.
And who's been playing worse than Angel Reese?
Yeah. I mean, she had got off to a slow start to her season because of injury, and she got off to a late start. So, you know, I'm not reading too much into it. But just Angel Reese has been, I mean, she's been an all-star as a rookie. She's been a top 20 player in the league as a rookie. It's not like this is coming out of nowhere. She was the most outstanding player of the Final Four.
But so you're saying Camila Cardoso.
Camila
Cardoso. If you could do a redraft, and if the Storm could keep their pick, and you know that you're getting Camila Cardoso with that pick, do you do that? Not knowing what we know now about the Storm, but just heading into it, do you just sit there and take Camila Cardoso? If it was like unanimous, the top three was going to be Caitlin Clark, Cameron Brink, Angel Reese, and the Storm could sit there at four, not get Neko Gwumike, not get Skylar Diggins-Smith, but have that player.
Do you think that's no?
You would still say no?
I would say in that case, it's worth it.
Worth it to go basically like all in for these next two seasons?
Yes. I mean, the other question that's the variable that lingers over this is, Neko Gwumike only signed a 1-year deal.
Yeah.
She played at Stanford. The WNBA is expanding to San Francisco next year. You don't have to do the windy pointing fingers to consider the possibility that she goes and signs with that team, depending on how this season finishes out. But
is she from the Bay Area?
She's not from there. She's from Houston.
A lot of people play at Stanford.
It's true.
Is that why there's a team in Connecticut? I actually really didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Kind of makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's almost no sports that are like, I mean, like maybe Indiana's like a bigger, like dating way back, but that you have a team in a place because of how good a college program is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that in the big three sports leagues, you would do that.
That's actually kind of incredible.
And in the Big Four, it's in the NHL, it's probably the opposite. The local hockey team is college hockey team is good because there's an NHL team there rather than the other way around. Although so, I don't know, Minnesota may have predated the existence of the North Stars.
Basically, like, winning is important right now. Is there a possibility? Is there any flexibility for the Storm long term? Because right now we're looking at the most likely outcome. Like, their chances of winning the championship are probably like...
Is there any flexibility? Literally every player in the league is going to be a free agent in 2026, so yeah.
But realistically speaking, who are those players?
Every player in the league. I mean, you're not going to probably sign players away from
the league. You're not going to sign every player in the league. But
could Seattle still be like the third choice among people because of the practice facility and the support here?
And being good in the interim is an important piece of that.
Correct.
Being good for these next 2 years, because you're out of the conversation if you're terrible for 2 years.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you probably would have gotten good in 2025 anyway, just because you would have this rookie and whoever you drafted in 2025. I mean, the other piece of the equation is the Storm didn't trade away the fourth pick for nothing. You know, it wasn't just a salary dump. They did get LA's 2026 first round pick. And even though LA is in that same situation I was just talking about where, well, probably they'll be good in 2025. Like if they drop Paige Beckers, who was at Climate Pledge Arena over the weekend, as part of her tour of the WNBA, I saw her in person at the Commissioner's Cup final.
Okay.
Where she was supporting her former UConn teammate, Dorca Juhasz, with the victorious Minnesota Lynx.
So Paige Beckers is most likely the number one pick in the draft next year?
Yes. Technically has another year of eligibility. She could go back into 2026, but I don't see that happening. And then
I think also the WNBA has changed, and it's a place where, like,
you're ready to go.
Oh, people are going to start coming out early. Like climate is going to change between obviously, I mean,
it's
there's
very
NIL
limited
money.
Rules, very limited opportunity for players to come out early.
Why?
Because you have to be either 22 the year of the draft and graduating, or 4 years removed.
That shit's going to change.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be the first. I don't think it's going to be the next CBA. They still got bigger fish to fry.
That's a ridiculous rule.
I have written about it. That I don't think it should exist.
Okay, well, that's going to change long term, but not in Paige Becker's terms.
I wrote about it in regards to more Paige Beckers than Caitlin Clark at that point after their freshman seasons.
Because Paige Beckers was the bigger star after her freshman year.
Yeah. National Player of the Year as a freshman.
Okay, so this still feels like, despite everything that's happened with Angel Reese, it still feels like the right process.
Yeah.
Do you think Angel Reese will ever be the best player on a championship team?
Probably not.
Okay. Then, I mean, if that's the case, like, what are the chances that Angel Reese is ever as good as Jewel Lloyd? Or as impactful to winning as Jewel Lloyd?
I think that's pretty plausible.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I don't think if Jewel Lloyd is your best player, you're probably a championship team. By the way, the low-key question is, I know I'm higher than Ezzie Megvigor than anyone else. Is she the Storm's best player?
Really?
Is she the timeline? That's a low-key question. But you also got to keep her happy, because she, like everyone else in the WNBA, will be a free agent after the 2025 season, after that one-year extension she signed.
Okay, fair enough.
So,
I'm going to say that they probably handle the situation right, though, overall.
Ezzie's really good. I'm just saying. The schedule before the Olympic break for the Storm is they close it out. Friday, they host Minnesota. That's almost a must win in some ways, I would say, to have a chance at catching the Lynx. I mean, there's a lot of WNBA season left, too. We just passed the midway point, but they are 0-3 against Minnesota.
Aren't the Lynx fading a little bit right now?
I mean, like I said, they have won two in a row with Nafisa Collier out of the lineup, so they are still two games up on the Storm at 16-6. It'd be a very, very nice one to get. And then Sunday against the Atlanta Dream to close out this 9-game homestand. Then Tuesday they will play another Kids Day game at Los Angeles against the lowly Sparks, who are 5-17 right now. So Storm obviously wish they had the Sparks 2025 draft pick, but 2026 is not so bad to have either.
Okay.
All right, that's all I've got this week. We've gotten this in barely over an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, this is we've taken a bye week this week before, right? Next week?
Next week, yeah, when I'm in Vegas is traditionally the bye week, but it's like around the same time of July when things quiet down.
That was before we cared about baseball, so.
Well, usually baseball is that the bye week is also the MLB All-Star game typically.
How long are you in Vegas for?
5 days.
So you'll be back to podcast like mid next week.
Correct.
Who are you interested in seeing in Vegas?
I mean, I'm interested in seeing pretty much all the rookies. I'll have a players to watch piece coming out on ESPN.com on Friday ahead of the opening of the Vegas Summer League.
Players to watch at Summer League.
Yeah. Okay. I did all the West players. Jonathan Givony is doing all the East players.
Nice.
So obviously I did say Bronny for the Lakers. I mean, Donovan Klingon, I'm interested to see if he shoots any threes, given that was a big part of his pre-draft workouts. I've only seen Zachary Richache at the Hoop Summit, so you know, it'll be interesting to see the number one pick in this study. I've never seen Alex Saar play. So plenty to follow.
All right. There you go. Well, next week it'll be the All-Star break. We'll have a Mariners mid-season perspective, and you'll be back to tell us about Vegas and maybe Vegas food as well. Is Nate Duncan going?
Oh, Nate Duncan is going, yes.
Do you have meals planned already?
I have two reservations for Sunday night.
Where?
Contingent on one for Best Friend, one for Lotus of Siam. Contingent on whether I go to one of those places on Monday. If I have to choose between them, it's going to be a tough call.
Yeah, what is your choice? Best Friend. I really feel like Best Friend was like really up there.
I agree, but I haven't been to Lotus. I didn't go to Lotus of Siam last year, so I'd kind of like to get back there. Or during Summer League, we went.
Yeah.
When we were there in June.
We went to Lotus of Siam?
Yes.
We went to both?
Yes.
That was the place that we went to first was Lotus of Siam?
Correct.
To me, Best Friend, it was like no question. Best Friend was better.
I'm still hoping I might be able to get to both of them.
Okay.
And then I'm trying the...
Is there something new? I feel like you've done all these.
Julian Serrano Tapas on Friday night or on Saturday night.
That's so the I'm new location?
Yeah. I'm Where's interested that to try that. That's in the Cosmo.
Okay.
Like all the best food. All right. Well, all the best food that's not off strip.
I was going to say, the real heads would tell you that the best food's off strip.
Correct. But there's a lot of very good food at the Cosmopolitan. So on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. That's where I'm going for lunch. Off strip for lunch.